Okay, well, I'll see what's in front of me anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they say it's the exact same spot, both sides. They're up for it, like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
Marlisa,
are you ready for this?
Everybody, the cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
UFOs over New York, and I am too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that the days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, and welcome to, to our listeners around the world, to edition 354 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This program gives you the opportunity to expand your mind and hear from and about credible people who've had incredible experiences. Tonight, Victor Vigiani is in studio with me. Evening, Victor. Good evening.
Good evening. Yes, here we go. I got mine on. I got yours on. Or what's the story? Hello.
I'm wearing them both.
Yes. Good evening to everyone.
And in studio also is Dave Furlot. Evening, Dave.
Good evening, Errol.
Oh, what a week it's been, huh?
Funny games.
Yes, Dave will be here momentarily with his take on it. And later, we'll catch up on crop formation, crop circle research. And the news of those kind of things with Nancy Talbot of BLT Research. Fascinating new image of a crop circle.
The formation is just amazing, and how the interweaving goes on. It just, I'm going to really be anticipating what she's saying about this one, I'll tell you.
Driving us here tonight at News Talk 1010 CFRB, the pilot in our master control, is Big Daddy Bidasige. I think I got it almost right, didn't I? Yeah, just a little out. Well, we'll get into that later. And flying Montreal's News Talk leader, CJAD 800, is Jim Pacheco. Evening, Jim. Is it nearly your birthday again? I understand that pretty soon it is. I know it only seems like a couple of months, but I think it was around this time last year.
Does he have a birthday every 2 or 3 months? Is that the way it happens?
No, it just seems like every 2 or 3 months.
Reborn.
You know, it's the last few years that does it. An interesting lineup tonight is the way it goes. Yeah. That herringbone crop formation is fascinating. The way that's... Yeah, herringbone, you know what a herringbone looks like?
It's sort of interwoven.
Interwoven at angles to one another, straight lines of, and the crop is laid down from the right at a 45 degree angle, and then from the left over the top of that, and then from the right again over the top of that, and then from the left, and all at 45 degree angle.
And the whole sequence is very orderly. It's not just sort of a mismatch. It's very coordinated.
Tidy. But it's not a circle. It's a square.
Yeah, I noticed that too. And a little different. Usually there's a sort of a circular or elliptical or crescent shape to most of this. This is rectangular shaped or angular.
We'll get into that one with Nancy Talbot after the news at the bottom of the hour.
Can hardly wait.
And the Russians have, in fact, solved the mystery of crop circles.
It's all sewn up and done.
It is. It's very neat and it's very tidy. A group of researchers in Russia claim they have solved the mystery of crop circles. According to them, plants bend as a result of microwave emissions caused by lightning strikes. And the researcher Stanislav Smirnov, how could I mispronounce that, who placed several stalks of cereals in a microwave oven with a glass of water, he said the stalks bent in exactly the same way as those usually found at crop circles. He said he now has to find out how microwave emissions appear on fields. He has a theory about where they come from underground, but he cannot prove it. And apparently, another Russian researcher, Anatoly Arizayev of the All Russian Electrical Hardware Institute, said the emissions are most likely the result of lightning strikes. He said that they cut crop circles at a lawn in their institute 50 years ago when such research was unheard of. Two young workers and he were testing high-voltage hardware. The cable that they used to supply the current was hanging 10 meters above the ground when suddenly it discharged an artificial lightning strike on the lawn below, and the grass bent over in even clockwise circles. Well, that explains the circles. Now, how do we explain the herringbone and those amazing...
How does lightning organize stalks of corn or wheat or whatever it is in such particular articulated manners?
Amazing geometric shapes.
It's just like a woman braiding her hair.
The herringbone,
It's the same sort of...
There you go. That's an even more elegant explanation.
It's just very fine and clear. And I defy any bolt of lightning to be that precise, that exact.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm not a scientist in that way, but...
It doesn't make sense.
I don't know.
It doesn't make sense, does it? New start time tonight for program 354, and if you're confused, then don't be, because we shall be here from 9 until 11 Eastern, and it's good to have you along. Hope you caught the notice of time change in the program last week. Victor wasn't here. You were on vacation, and you had a jolly, splendid time.
Absolutely splendid time. The western part of our country is astounding. I'd never been out there before.
Really?
Yeah, it's my first
time. Did you go to Lake Louise?
Got Lake Louise, and it's just... I don't know. It's just an amazing part of the country, and just toured around for probably...
Did you go to the Columbia Glacier?
Didn't make it to the glacier. We had been in glaciers at New Zealand. So we figured, let's just experience the other part. Mm-hmm. Went to Emerald Lake, Moraine Lake. These places are just hidden jewels among those mountains.
And they have UFOs there, too.
From what I hear.
Yeah, there have been reports from there. We'll come back with Dave for a lot, and we'll get Dave's take on things. This week,
here with his take on it, is Dave Furlong.
Last week, we had a caller by the name of Annie who asked a rather simple question. Where is the proof of UFOs? In answer to that important question, I'm going to repeat something I said back almost 100 shows ago. One thing that always baffles me about the pursuit of truth regarding UFOs is that everybody talks about there being no proof. And even ufologists keep talking about everything being circumstantial evidence. The skeptics, the debunkers, keep demanding to see the proof. They claim the photographs are blurry or indistinct or sharp, but obviously hoaxed. They go on to claim that the reports from people who have seen or encountered UFOs are fabricated or have been coached responses by the ufologists who investigate the case. What is most interesting is when a skeptic or a debunker does a turnaround because they have had their own UFO personal encounter or sighting. As soon as something like that happens, however, the others immediately attempt to discredit the individual by saying the person is lying or trying to pull a fast one or just has been living a deluded existence. Now, I have to admit that some of the images captured on film and videotape are blurry, and that almost all of the reports that have been filed are presented as second- or third-hand testimony. But notice something. I said almost all. We've played tapes on Strange Days Indeed. One of the tapes we have played is of the Trumbull County incident, where the Trumbull County Police Force were sent out to investigate people calling in about seeing strange things in the sky on December 14, 1994. Now, the big difference in that report and any other report about any UFO sighting is that the Trumbull County incident is not second or third hand, because we listened to the actual 911 tapes of conversations between the dispatcher and the police officers and other officials in real time. Kenny Young, who tracked down the tapes, put them together, merely edited out the dead ear between the calls. But he did no other editing of anything that was ever said on that tape. What this means is that we, the listener, have a first-hand account of what happened on that night in 1994. In other words, it's as though we were there, experiencing the same thing that the officers and the dispatcher experienced. It also means that finally we have real proof of the existence of UFOs. Here's the crux of the matter. The only way you could not accept those tapes as proof is by believing one or more other reasons for the existence of the tapes. Firstly, maybe Kenny Young fabricated the whole thing by getting some actors and putting together a script, recording them on tape. Maybe he had nothing better to do and put this whole thing together just to what? Make some money, get some fame, have a little joke on the rest of us? Well, shooting the theory down very easily right now, remember that to impersonate a police officer is a criminal offense. And many times on the tape, people were identifying themselves as being with the Trumbull County Police. Okay, Dave, that one doesn't cut it. How about the police and the department? They were having a boring night. They decided to put the whole thing together as a nice elaborate joke. As inane as that particular idea is, let's just quickly shoot it down by saying that if a police force anywhere were to do something like that, they'd be looking for jobs elsewhere or incarcerated on federal charges. Fine, that doesn't cut it either. Maybe the whole police department were caught up in some kind of mass hypnosis or some other kind of psychological problem that made them all go chasing this large, luminous, saucer-shaped object that made no sound. Maybe when one of them started saying they saw it, they were impressing on the others that they have to be seeing it too. Okay, that sounds really good, except for one tiny little problem. From the outset of the tape, you can hear the dispatcher and some of the other officers joking about having to go look at something that was not going to be anything. See, that's the problem with the entire Trumbull County incident. The people who were being recorded initially didn't believe in UFOs. Nor did they believe they were going to see anything on that particular night. Matter of fact, they were having a really good laugh in the beginning. But as they discovered more and more things, they quickly changed from laughter to being downright scared, with at least one police officer saying a prayer on the tape because he was afraid the UFO he had seen earlier was now flying toward him. People have been asking for proof that UFOs are flying around in our skies, and they don't believe things they read or hear being reported as second or third-hand information. They don't believe in the pictures or videotape that's been shown to them, but now the choice is simple. Listen to the tape of the Trumbull County incident, and you have to quickly realize that you are listening to the proof, exactly as it happened, and from the people who were there on December the 14th. In other words, Annie, yeah, there is proof of UFOs as long as you know where to look for it. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Vermont, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
You hear these tapes, there's almost a sense of disbelief and amazement by the dispatchers and the officers when they have to address this issue of a UFO sighting.
2 AM 30, a UFO.
Go ahead.
4636 Wilkerson Road. The complaint apparently called Lebanon PD advising they see a bright colored disc, and they advise the object is stationary in the sky.
What is it? I have no idea, and you wouldn't believe it if you came out and saw it. Just sitting stationary and blinking. There's probably five different colors. There's two of them, and they've stayed in the exact same spot the whole time. They're not stars, I can tell you that. I don't know what they are.
Oh, my God. What? Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
What, Weezer?
I ain't ready for this. That's a plane. Oh, thank God.
Well, I get nervous when they're coming right at me.
Yeah, the Trumbull County Police Chief. Good take, Dave.
Hey, thank you.
If you want to hear the whole of that that interview that we did with Kenny Young back in program 100 all those years ago.
Back that far, my
back
gosh.
That far. Mm. You can hear the whole interview with Kenny, and I think that was a two-hour interview, and that is available at virtuallystrange.net. Click Strange Days Indeed, and then on the logo at the top of the page on the left-hand side, you'll see Archives. Click that, and it'll take you to the Archives, and then Program 100. Click that. It's a real media, real audio file, and you can go listen to that, Annie, if you're able to. I know, there were just so many things to tell Annie last week, and there just wasn't the time.
Yeah, we just couldn't fit them in. And it
sounds like she was a real bookmark that evening.
Yeah.
Who's good?
It was good, yeah. It was interesting because she parroted the party line. You know, okay. All the things that the skeptics have said on television,
right.
Annie parroted, you know. So it was...
nice little back and forth, it
yes,
sounds like.
It was an interesting moment or three, but seriously, folks, go listen to that Trumbull County. And go get some books, you know, get Richard Hall's... any book by Richard Hall, go find David Jacobs, the book that that Dave Jacobs edited for University Press of Kansas, or Kansas University Press, Abductions. Go get the proceedings of the MIT conference, the abduction conference at MIT.
That Courtney Bryant
wrote, yeah.
I think that was probably the most definitive study of a skeptic, or written by a skeptic. He went into that blind.
Eyes wide closed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He was the total, and he came out of that, and the book that he wrote, I remember reading it in Florida one summer, and it just blew me away. This individual completely turned his mind around in terms of not being a believer, but said, listen, this information is very, very significant. We have to start paying attention to it. And he did it in so many different ways. He looked at abductions, pilot reports, just general sightings. It was a brilliantly written document.
Yeah, he's the guy that says for the first time in our opener, that says for the first time in history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Mm-hmm. What else can you say?
Yes, yes.
Gosh, I hope it's a plane.
Oh, geez, I hope it's a plane. I ain't ready for this.
That is so dramatic.
It is, though, isn't it, though? An email here, stellar take tonight, Dave Frelott, proof positive. See, Annie, better get your gun.
Good one.
Yes. Yeah. And Annie, get your gun is opening here in Toronto this fall, too.
So yes.
There's a plug for that nice Mr. Mirish.
As inadvertent as it was.
Yes, it was. Well, yeah, certainly by Alfred. The email address, sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Love to get email from you. And, the biblical quotes I'm not crazy about.
Stay away from those?
Well, no, not even that, you know, but they keep coming in every week, and it's just masses and masses and masses of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's no time to go through it. Victor Vigiani in studio, and Dave Frelott across the desk. 10 minutes, eh?
Well, let's just...
I tell you what, let's do this. Let's open up the phone lines.
Go ahead.
Yeah? I have.
Sounds like a good idea.
That could be a lot of fun. We might get Annie again.
Okay. Yeah, that could be a lot of fun. 1-866-866-7387 is the number, both in Ontario and Quebec. 1-866-866-7387. Let's see how many of you really want to get into a discussion about UFOs. 1-866-866-7387. And let's make the control room here in Toronto totally bananas. And the phones are dead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, somebody turned the phones off.
Yeah. So there was actually an interesting email posted to the UFO updates list today. From Michael Sala, explaining exopolitics. Yeah. So let me just call that up because I want to read a little segment for both of you gentlemen, because you should hear this, because I know you weren't online today, either of you. So So let's go to the updates mailing list, and it is today, and you could do this too. You know, we're coming up for 60,000 messages at the archive, probably tomorrow.
60,000.
Probably tomorrow. Where is that? And we keep talking about Michael Sala, and we have had him on this program, and, you know, I let him go, and I don't know if you were in that night or not, but I just kept saying,
And that was your response?
Yeah, and this was a while, you know, this was right after he was, you know, because he was teaching at American University in Washington.
Right. Yeah.
And he was let go because apparently of his position on UFOs. And
so what's the quote that you wanted to...
Exopolitics is neither at the fringes, nor is it something relatively new to UFO studies that I, Stephen Greer... Alfred Weber, or Weber, or others have introduced.
So he's saying that it's been around for a long time.
It's been around for a long time, and Stephen Greer, and well, I know Alfred Weber has been, you know, actively involved exopolitically, whatever that means. And Michael Sala is a relative newcomer to it, but I wasn't aware that Stephen Greer.
That's not something that I associate with that name, no.
No, I mean, you know, doing stupid things at national press conferences when you're presenting UFO witnesses is seems to be his major claim to fame.
Yeah, having everything all lined up and then...
And then talking about free energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really too bad.
Well, gentlemen,
comments?
I still live with my comment.
Yes.
Exopolitics, people who believe that Men in Black was a documentary. I'm sorry, but that is my take on that.
Yes. Hey, there's an upcoming UFO conference here in Toronto.
That's correct, yes.
Yes, and that is happening when, Victor?
It's happening on September 25th, Sunday, September 25th, at Convocation Hall here in Toronto, University of Toronto campus. And it's a conference, a symposium on planetary directions, about disclosure, and four major speakers, Paula Harris, Stanton Friedman, Richard Dolan, and Stephen G. Bassett. And we're going to have those four people headlining the program at Convocation Hall beginning at 9:30.
It's a Sunday.
That's right. It is a Sunday. And we're hoping that this conference will be, well, we know that the conference is the first of its kind here in Toronto. Something like this has never happened here in the city before. And we're hoping that we get a good turnout, and we're hoping that people really... We are praying for good turnout.
We're hoping that nobody shows up.
Well, just with that cast of characters out there during that conference, we can't miss.
Well,
it's impossible.
I hope
those are
that's
some
right.
pretty powerful names.
My hope is that we get the right people coming out to listen to the messages from these people, and I'm hoping that the journalists we're very intent on targeting the journalists, and also we're looking at targeting the academic component in all the universities, and we've got a plan in motion to notify all the department heads of all the major universities here in Southern Ontario, and even out west and east, as far east as Montreal and up into Windsor. And we're hoping that some of the departments of sociology, anthropology, political science receive the message about coming to the conference here in Toronto on September 25th, and that they open their eyes to the potential that this is not just something that's cannon fodder, it's not just speculation, it's not just myth, there's something very, very strange going on, and we better start paying attention to the evidence. I mean, you can talk about exopolitics, you can talk about ufology, you can talk about anything you want. The bottom line is there's something very, very strange going on in the skies. It's been documented for decades, if not centuries, and we fail to look at all the information. And this is our attempt at bringing the information forward, and we're hoping that people will actually...
basically show up at the conference with an open mind.
That's right.
That's all we ask.
August the 12th is a very important day, because that's the day that the tickets go on sale UFT Tix Agency. That's at the website. So if you want to look at the website, we're inviting you to go to our own website, and it's exopoliticstoronto.com. That's exopoliticstoronto.com. And then from there, you can link to the University of Toronto Tix to buy your tickets, and that will begin August the 12th.
You can also get to that website via tonight's program. Actually, the program page, there's a banner right above tonight's program listing, and you can click that and get there.
Yeah, just go to SDI and click on it from there.
Mm. There. The BLT research team's primary focus is crop circles, the discovery, scientific documentation, and evaluation of physical changes induced in plants, soils, and other materials at crop circle sites by the energy or energy system responsible for creating them. And to determine if possible, BLT extracts from these data the specific nature and source of these energies. It's their intent to publish these research results in peer-reviewed scientific journals and to disseminate the information to the general public through lectures, mainstream articles, the internet, and, of course, programs like this. Nancy Talbot joins us from the BLT research team. Good evening, Nancy.
Hi. I know you're in Montreal, so I think you ought to learn that I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I'm in Toronto.
You're in Toronto?
Yeah, but the program is also going into Montreal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm in Cambridge, right outside of Boston. That's where the BLT team is. That's where the offices are.
I'm looking at it now, as you say it, in the left-hand side of your website. And I apologize. There's just so much going on here. And there. Did you manage to get the thing off the stove?
I did.
Oh, good.
I did. I was making, I only cook once or twice a week, and I try to make stuff for the whole week, you know?
Yeah, and put it away. And
I was at a critical phase, and I needed 5 more minutes.
I love it.
Well, we failed. Actually, we imparted more information. It wasn't so much we never fill in this program. We never have enough time to do that.
No.
Some interesting things going on in the crop formation world this month, huh?
Interesting things constantly going on in the crop circle world, many of which I don't understand. I wish I could tell you I knew what it was all about, but I don't.
Mm-hmm.
However, there have been a number of updates recently. Do you mind if I tell your listeners about the website so they can go right to these pages if they'd like to?
They can go via tonight's program listing, and there are actually three links to your site there: scientific findings, the recent formations, and
the update section.
And the update section.
Good. It's bltresearch.com, and it's the update section that we're going to talk about a lot tonight.
Mm-hmm.
The first one at the bottom of the list there concerns the magnetic particles in crop circle soils. Now, I don't know if you remember, but back in 1993 in England, there was a crop formation late in August. And in that particular event, for the first time, we found a metallic-looking glaze covering some of the plants in the centers of various parts of the formation.
Mm-hmm.
That glaze was sampled, as were a number of soils also from the formation. And eventually, it was determined by William Levingood, the biophysicist in Michigan who did this work, and John Burke, who's the B in BLT, that this was a meteoritic glaze that had been caused because the Perseids meteor shower was going on during the time that formation occurred. And it's their opinion that tiny little microscopic particles of meteoritic iron, which were filtering down to Earth because of all the meteorites coming into the atmosphere, had gotten drawn into this atmospheric energy system, heated up by the microwaves emitted by the system, which turned these particles into a molten material, which then impacted the plants as the energy system, you know, hit the Earth. Now, I don't know finally if that will be the final answer, but so far, it's the best explanation for this metallic glaze, which is magnetic and very pure iron. Subsequently, we began sampling crop circles regularly, the soils. Prior to that, we'd only looked at the plants. And we have now found this metallic material, this magnetic stuff, in a large proportion of the crop circles, frequently in tiny little spherules. These are, say, 10 to 50 microns in diameter, about the size of a pencil point. And these little spheres, and they're perfect spheres, will be distributed most often around the edges of circular components of a crop circle, or sometimes they're deposited linearly, meaning that the numbers increase as you go farther and farther away from the center. Very interesting.
Isn't
when you
it,
find
though?
That.
Yeah, yeah.
And we assume that the origin is still meteoritic dust, even though, you know, there are not meteor showers all the time, of course. There is, however, meteoritic dust filtering down to Earth, all over the Earth, all the time, in varying amounts, depending on whether there are, you know, meteor showers going on or not. And Levengood and Burke are of the opinion that this material, because it's so tiny and so light and so delicate, gets drawn in by the magnetic fields given off by the crop circle energy, you know, system, and then heated up by the microwaves that are also being given off by this plasma system. And then they form these spheres, usually, as they fall down through the Earth, just the way lead shot used to do back in the Revolutionary War. When we made lead shot, we would build shot towers, heat the lead up at the top, you know, drop it off in small amounts, and of course it forms a ball on the way down as it cools off. It's the same basic idea as to what we think is going on in this magnetic material.
Now, Nancy, could I just interrupt you there for a second?
Sure.
You've got this anomaly of these small spheres. One of my questions to you would be, does this or would it occur in any other incidents here on Earth? Is there another process, either be it heat within the Earth itself or something, where it's replicated somehow in some other way?
There is another kind of tiny little sphere that is part of the effluvia, the debris that is produced in coal-burning power plants. The stuff that goes up the smokestack produces also tiny little spheres, although they don't tend to be as small as the ones we're finding. And further, they tend primarily to be glassy rather than this magnetic iron.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But because before the emission standards that we now have came into place, this stuff was spewing out of smokestacks all over the place. And so one of the things that has to be done is some very precise testing to establish which kind of spheres we're looking at. These fly ash spheres, as they're called, really do exist, as far as we can tell, probably all over the Earth's surface now.
Now, Nancy, very quickly, anywhere outside of those actual circles, are we getting into this material as well?
You will find fly ash everywhere.
No, I'm talking about the tiny spheres.
The magnetic spheres?
Yeah.
The iron? Generally speaking, they do not extend in any great numbers beyond 20, 30, 40 feet outside. They're usually clustered right around the edges of the formations. Now, the only knowledge we have of these is the formations that we have sampled, and we tend to extend the sampling lines in two, three, four directions away out into the field, you know, away from the formation, perhaps as far as 500, 700, 800 feet away. And what we observe most often is that the numbers drop off dramatically at about 5 to 10 feet outside the formations, and then are reduced to a very tiny number elsewhere in the field.
Now, are these in the formations that you found these spherules, Are you finding the same anomalies in the soil and in the plant, whatever the crop happens to be? Because when you were last on, there were interesting changes at the molecular level in the plants and the soil that could have only been caused by incredible heat.
Well, heat is involved, you see, in creating these too.
Yes.
The microwave radiation, we think, is the heating agency involved in all of the effects related to heat, the plant effects, and then the X-ray diffraction work that we did on the clay minerals also showed a very intense heat source. But in that case, we cannot explain it as microwave, partly because the intensity level was so great, and furthermore, since the changes in the clays were found at exactly the same locations as the changes in the plants, we know that the heat involved that would be required to cause the changes in the clays would have incinerated the plants. So
well, exactly.
That's a very big question.
Mm-hmm.
How in the world did those two effects occur at the same locations when a very brief burst of microwaves could be responsible for what we're seeing in the plants, but it could not possibly be responsible for the changes in the clays?
Incredible.
The plants should have been destroyed, is what you're saying.
Yeah. They would have been in any way that we know that this process of the changes in the clays, this is an increase in the on the atomic level of the crystalline structure of the clays. And the only things that caused that, known to the mineralogist who headed up this study, was usually in nature it occurs as a process of mountains building up over sediments, and it's the pressure of the mountains pressing down on the sediments for hundreds or thousands of years that causes these changes in the clays. Obviously, in a crop circle, you don't have any pressure involved, not the pressure of mountains, because, you know, the plants would be obliterated. I mean, that sort of pressure would simply mush them into nothingness.
Yes.
And yet, of course, that's not the case. The only other known cause is very intense heat for long periods of time, which common sense tells you would have incinerated the field.
Nancy, we need to break for the news at the top of the hour here. We'll come back and pick it up the other side. You know, every time I hear you talk, it just boggles my brain as to why more scientists aren't interested in the phenomena that you're discovering.
Because they don't know about it.
Yeah, and they don't want to know about it. It would get in the way of their beliefs. I don't know whether you've heard about this, Nancy, but Paul Anderson of the Canadian Crop Circle Research Network informed the UFO Updates email list today that the first Canadian crop circle formation for 2005 has been reported just north of Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. It was found on July 22nd.
It's not a crop circle. That announcement, it's some sort of a depression in...
Uh-oh.
She went back to her cooking.
Oh, my.
That's not a good sound on radio, is it?
Oh, it's not. I wonder,
She said it's not a crop circle,
yeah,
but
it's
a depression.
Depression.
Although the previous report from June 2nd, Paul goes on to say, is actually... its physical nature is grass missing, not flattened, making the Prince Albert Formation the first standard-type crop circle. So the one that she's referring to, the one that Nancy is referring to, was back on June 2nd. This one was the Prince Albert, the first official crop circle was reported on August 3rd by CTV News, and the exact location is being kept confidential. It's a single circle in sloughgrass, approximately 60 feet in diameter. The lay is in one direction, not swirled. Unusual lights were reported the night before the formation was found, and further details are pending. This is hot off the wire on the UFO updates list this afternoon, Nancy. Hello, Nancy.
Talked to both Paul and the woman who found it, and it's not a crop formation. The woman who has been investigating it, her opinion is that this is simply a depression in a wet, slough, I guess they call it, area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's partially circular. It is not really a circle.
Ah.
And it appears to be some sort of a downburst rather than anything like a real crop circle.
Uh-huh.
That was her opinion.
Okay.
And Paul had gotten, he got a notice in the mail, which he then forwarded on to people.
Mm-hmm.
Now he knows about the information from the field itself, so I'm certain he's going to be sending around something else very quickly.
A retraction.
Well, it appears that this particular thing is more likely to, it's certainly not a crop circle.
Uh-huh.
It's something else, and the light phenomena is interesting. Maybe it's associated, maybe it's not, but it doesn't appear to be the crop circle phenomenon.
Ah. Mm. Well, there you go. So that takes care of that. But the herringbone, which we touched on briefly at the beginning of the program tonight, is fascinating.
Well, I would like, if I can, to finish the conversation about the magnetic particles.
Oh, okay. Let's do that. Yeah, because that was even more fascinating.
And then go on to something else in Canada from last year, which is important to discuss.
Okay.
The magnetic particles. This whole investigation was published in the scientific literature in the journal Scientific Exploration in 1995 by Levin, Good, and Burke.
Mm-hmm.
Several years after that, an Englishman, unknown to us directly, also received some material which he was told came from that same field. He did work independently of ours and came up with a similar conclusion, not so much the meteoritic origin, but clearly that this was a magnetic iron which had been heated.
Mm.
And he published this information on a website in England. Then, very curiously, many years afterward, one of these well-known hoaxers in England produced another material to this guy in England, saying that he, in fact, had made the formation. He had spread these, what he called, iron filings around. And that, in fact, was what both Levin Good and this guy in England, whose name is Ashby, had been examining. Somehow he got the confidence of this Ashby in England, and Ashby did some more work. This was just this year.
Mm-hmm.
And now has recanted his original position, claiming that he thinks that these iron filings are, in fact, what he had been looking at originally. However,
how can you mistake iron filings for
spheres? And what we've done now is we have replied to his second posting, and what I've done on the website is list one by one each of the paper, then his paper, then the next thing, so that anybody who's interested in following this argument can, from that one place on the website, check all of these reports, read them through themselves, and determine, come to a conclusion themselves. The point was to make every bit of the information available and then just let the public make their own minds up about it.
So that's BLTresearch.com. BLT is in Baker, Levin Good.
As in Burke.
Burke, Levin Good,
and Talbot.
Yes. BLTresearch.com.
So anyone particularly interested in the meteoritic iron argument can go to the updates page, and the whole thing is there. Now, something perhaps equally interesting to Canadians, because it did in fact happen in Canada, was a formation, or two formations actually, in Mission, B.C., and these occurred back in 2002, and they were in corn, in maize, in tall field corn.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two of them, one on either side of a highway. One, in fact, was investigated fairly thoroughly. We couldn't manage both of them. But the one that we did investigate started off as a simple circle with a spur. Sometime in late August, this occurred. Subsequently, when investigators went back, they discovered a great long pathway attached to the other end. This was in September. And then later on in September, there were even some more additions. This was one of these formations that is kept evolving. And this does happen in crop circles sometimes.
Mm.
Now, on the second or third visit to this site, Paul Anderson, who runs the CCCRN, and Laurel Conrad, who's one of the field workers in Canada, a superb field worker, I might add, went to the site and observed absolutely blackened stems. Now, this was a considerable time after the formations had occurred, but they saw these, I mean, what looked like, for all the world, like burning. The stems were totally blackened, and they very reasonably thought that this represented burning. Samples were taken, and we then did some testing, and what we've discovered, again in this case, as we have seen in several others, that when you see this marked blackening, the chances are most likely that it is Eustalego. This is an opportunistic fungus that feeds on the nutrients inside plant stems.
Mm-hmm.
When the stems are broken and exposed to the air, the tiny little spores of this fungus, which are in the air all the time, attach themselves to these places. And as they feed and multiply, you get this very dark blackening. It looks exactly like it'd been hit by lightning or something. But the way you can tell the difference is that if it's carbon, it's likely to come off on your fingers when you wipe your fingers over it, and it should smell, like carbon, like burning.
Like burning, yeah.
And that was not the case. Even as dramatic as this was, it turns out in this case it was nothing more than Eustalego. So it's important for people visiting crop circles to know if there has been a time period since it occurred and there are broken stalks at all, this blackening is likely to occur. Sometimes even it's a dark red because there are other opportunistic molds that are bright red in color. And so you have to be very careful in coming to a conclusion about what has happened because it can look exactly like a carbon blackening and not be that.
Hmm. Nancy, I just want to ask you a quick question. You refer back to you again about the evolving nature of these two circles on both sides of the highway. How long did this evolution take place? Was it a couple of days or weeks? Or
I can give you the dates they've given me. The formations were first observed in late August of 2002.
Mm-hmm.
When investigators got there on September 20th, an addition had already occurred.
Hmm.
And then, at the very end of September, the 30th, all these other additions had occurred.
So these things were left to be. They were left to sit. They weren't disturbed in any way.
They were kind of remote, and as far as we know, nobody was down there. There was no evidence it's conceivable that some of these additions were human-created because they weren't all tested.
I see.
But in other cases, in the UK and in other places, occasionally, crop circles do get additions. Usually, though, it's within a day or two of the original formation. Sometimes another whole aspect of it will go down.
Mm-hmm.
But it's relatively rare, and whether in this case some of the parts were made by people, I don't know for sure.
Mm. But what's interesting is that not only are you covering the anomalies, but you're covering the nature in the research, where things need to be explained as natural phenomena, as in fungus, then you're doing that.
Well, the idea is to rule out whatever we can, because then you're left with what you can't explain.
Yeah. Nancy Talbot is our guest, BLT Research. Go take a look at the website. There's fascinating stuff there and links to all kinds of amazing images of crop formations. BLTResearch.com. And Victor and I and Dave have been looking at the website and looking at some of the graphs and numbers there, going, my God, I haven't got a clue what it means. However, we decided that it wasn't for Victor and Dave and myself. It was for the scientists who care to go to BLTResearch.com and look at the findings that the team has put together and online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely to get a good idea.
Well, it's not designed for scientists. It's designed for anybody who wants to learn.
There goes my wrist being slapped again.
Well, it isn't designed for scientists. In fact, I've gone to a lot of trouble to write, to explain what each of the tests are and why they're done and what they're looking at, so that people can see that there is a very strong argument for the reality of the phenomenon, that crop circles, even though we all know that people make some of them, that in fact it is not people with planks and boards responsible for the large majority of them.
With a couple of jugs of cider in them, mm-hmm. Doug and Dave.
So just extending that line of reasoning, Nancy, can you speculate on the kinds of things that might be responsible for this type of occurrence?
I can tell you what the one scientific hypothesis that's been offered, whether it ends up being the final answer, nobody knows for sure. But this was presented by the biophysicist in Michigan again, Levengood, who did all of the early plant work. And he believes that this is some sort of an atmospheric plasma system. This is electrified air masses, which he believes are forming in the ionosphere. This is very high up, then descending in a spiraling motion towards the Earth's surface. And plasmas are known to physicists to emit microwaves when they spiral. They're known to have very unusual electrical fields associated with them, and also to have these strong magnetic fields. And all of these findings, you see, are part of what he has discovered in the changes in the plants. We know that the elongated nodes and the expulsion cavities are caused by heating up the moisture inside the plant stems. As that moisture is heated up, it turns to steam. And at the top of the plants, you have a very elastic outer fiber. It stretches very easily when the top of the plant is quite young. And so as that steam builds up at the top of the plant, it seeps out. And as it does so, it stretches the nodes. And we find these stretched nodes in crop circle plants all the time. Farther down the plant stem, the fibers are very tough. That's how the plant can stand up. And the steam builds up there at the nodes. And because those fibers are so tough, they will not stretch. And what happens is exactly what would happen in your microwave oven if you stuck an egg in, for instance, and turned it on. Eventually, it heats up to the point where it explodes. And that's precisely what we think is happening lower down on the plant stems.
Now, by any chance, does this mean that we have had these kind of crop formations going back hundreds of years?
They have, in fact, been documented back to the 1600s. We have very clear references to them as far back as 1668. And if Levengood is correct, and this is a natural phenomenon, simply a natural phenomenon, there would be a strong reason to expect that we would have seen them historically, you know, in times gone by.
Mm-hmm.
However, the X-ray diffraction study, which we completed a couple of years ago, this is the one that looked at the crystalline structure in the clay minerals. That, of course, produced this evidence of either extreme pressure or extreme heat, which is what is required to change the structure of the clays. And in that case, the microwave idea doesn't fit, you know, the evidence. It's another layer that's been added and makes you question the original hypothesis because it doesn't cover this new finding.
Nancy Talbot of BLT Research, BLTResearch.com is the website. Go look at it. There's fascinating stuff there and a lot more than we're going to have time to talk about tonight. Oh, Nancy, the X-ray diffraction study is fascinating.
That is fairly sophisticated, and you have to, if you read the very beginning part of it, it's written for lay people, the beginning part, which explains precisely what our objectives were and what, you know, it's very simple.
Mm-hmm.
You try to read the rest of it, it's kind of complex.
Yeah.
But, you know, the main thing, the important thing, is that all of the studies so far indicate that an energy system, probably not consisting of a single energy, but having multiple energies involved in it, is involved, and that at least one of those components is a heating agency. Microwaves are the most likely heating agency for some of the effects we've observed. The XRD study indicated that heat much more intense was present. And in fact, the scientist who was in charge of that study, who happens to have been the head of the Department of Earth Sciences at Dartmouth College, his opinion was, when the work was done, that we had to be looking at an energy unknown to science, because we could not explain all of the effects we observed by any known energy in science, you know, that science currently knows about. And I think that's more where we really are. There's another case on the updates page that kind of indicates this, and that was this ice pictogram that we examined in Norway. And in this case, this is not a typical crop circle, but it is a typical crop circle design that was formed out of ice, ridges of ice, on top of a field in the middle of winter. Now, in this case, we thought, well, maybe there was something underneath the ground that encouraged, you know, this design to form on the surface. Mm-hmm. Turns out there was nothing down there, and there never had been anything down there, at least so far as any of the locals knew. Then we thought, well, maybe there had been a structure on top of the earth that had left some sort of an impression in the ground, and that the water had collected and built up these ice rings. Turns out that that is not the case. So what we did was, we had soil samples taken, both in the rings and then considerably outside them for controls, and we exposed these soil samples to a chemical analysis known as infrared spectroscopy. What we were looking for was any indication of a chemical which could have been applied right to the ground, which might have resulted in causing snow to melt into water, which would then form these ice ridges, you know? And the infrared analysis clearly indicated no contamination whatsoever. There was absolutely nothing in the soils from the rings that wasn't also in the soils, the control soils, outside. And at that point, what we're left with is that apparently something in the air over this field emitted some sort of energy down to the crop, you know, to the top of the field, probably causing the snow to melt in this precise ring design. And then, of course, it refroze as soon as it got cold enough into the design, which then stayed there for a considerable period of time. Again, some energy apparently unknown to science and emitted by who knows what.
Exactly. I want to, which leads us actually to a couple of emails that I'd like to read you. Ask Nancy if they think that natural phenomena is responsible for the elaborate circle or designs.
All right. First of all, depends on who you mean by they. Some of the scientists that we work with do think that.
A BLT, presumably, yes.
Well, BLT now involves 13 or 14 different scientists, plus all the field workers and myself. Now, a few of these scientists are convinced that we are looking at some unknown natural phenomenon. Other of these scientists are not at all sure that that's what we're looking at, and a few of them subscribe to the idea of other dimensions, other, you know, extraterrestrial events, things of that sort. So you have a wide range of opinions or possible opinions going in, but most of the scientists really don't subscribe totally to any one particular point of view, and if they did, it wouldn't be good. It's better that they simply have open minds and look at the data and go from there. Among the field workers and those, the rest of us, there is also a huge range of opinions about what is going on. Some people subscribing to the unknown natural phenomenon idea. Some people who consider earth energies, you know, of some sort, others that think about interdimensional realities or extraterrestrial realities or Lord knows what. I think a lot of us have this impression that a consciousness of some sort is involved. Now, you have to realize when you're talking about the intricate, the complex designs, that some of these are man-made. And since not all of them are tested, we don't have any way of knowing in one given summer, for instance,
which is which.
Yeah. You have to test them to know.
Mm-hmm.
We know that a certain number of them are man-made, particularly in England. They can do very complex events, apparently. But we also know, because we have tested some of the intricate designs, that some of them are not man-made, some quite intricate designs. So if the phenomenon can do anything from a simple circle to these, you know, very incredibly complex things, it's hard to escape the idea that something beyond a completely natural meaning of nature, unconscious, so to speak, is going on. But then, of course, you have people who think that perhaps nature itself has a kind of consciousness that we are unaware of.
You have to consider all possibilities,
yes.
I guess.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot to think about there.
Going from the point of view of just strictly science, and you say that some scientists are in one camp or another, as in most, you know, kind of scientific speculation, how do you get from the leap of just pure science, of which your website is really kind of portraying for everyone, and then leap to this consciousness that might be responsible? How do you see those science making those kinds of links?
I'm not sure whether science itself ever will. Science itself is not designed to... Its intention is to deal with physical realities. Its limitations are that. Whether a new science will emerge dealing with things like consciousness and with non-physical realities, I don't know. There is definitely a movement among many physicists in this direction, starting to deal with the notion of consciousness. What is it? And, you know, what are the different degrees of it? What are the different aspects of it?
Mm-hmm.
Do plants and trees and whatever have consciousness? These are questions that the science community as a whole has never dealt with. As they do more and more, perhaps they'll find that this fits into that realm. Perhaps they won't.
Yeah, the secret life of plants. Huh?
Yes.
We
may be more complex than we know.
I would say the way the indicators are. Nancy Talbot is our guest, and we will continue talking about the phenomena that surround crop formations, crop circles. Dave Ferlat in studio, Victor Vigiani also. It's interesting, you know, Nancy Talbot, I've been saying for a while that I've got this feeling that everything that is... that interests me, and I know a lot of UFO researchers secretly feel like this, is that what we call the paranormal and what we're observing in the UFO world are interconnected and go back for millennia.
Interconnected with all the other various things labeled paranormal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that particular observation is becoming more prevalent among many of the crop circle people also, because as you do this work and as you talk to, in my case, I talk to hundreds of farmers and landowners and people on whose properties these crop circles occur, you know. And over the years, I have noticed that many of these people are telling me completely spontaneously of events which are much more UFO-like than they are, you know, that preceded or predated the actual appearance of the crop circles. And I never mention UFOs in my interviews because I don't want to lead these people at all, but I'm finding that very frequently they will begin to report to me. There's a part in the interview that I do where I'm asking about whether or not they noticed television interference on the night that they think the crop circle formed? Did they notice smoke alarms going off in the house for no reason? Did they notice a dead battery in their car the next morning, or their tractors?
Mm.
Were the animals behaving unusual? Things like this, you know?
Mm.
And it's in that part of the interview that frequently now the farmer, the rancher, the landowner will begin to tell me completely on their own about a UFO observation or an encounter of some sort that they have had, sometimes just in the days preceding the event, sometimes weeks, months, or even years previously.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm hearing from this is that they are drawing the correlation between the two all by themselves.
Hmm.
They perceive that something is similar in the events they witnessed before and the occurrence of the crop circle.
By the very nature of their occupations, their you know, their life choices, they're pragmatists. They're very down to earth.
Yes, they are.
And they ain't going to be making no fairy stories up.
No.
Most of them don't. They tell me, it's so funny, they'll tell me that they have never told a soul, not their wives, not their husbands, not their neighbors. And the reason usually is that they have this fear of ridicule, mm-hmm. of people thinking they're fools. And when I first started to notice this was a good many years ago in a small town in Saskatchewan, actually, where large numbers of crop circles had occurred that summer. And it turned out, when I interviewed each of the farmers, which I did, that every single one, except for one, reported this sort of phenomenon in their life, either immediately before or at some time before the actual crop circle event. And so when I was through that summer, I called all the farmers back and said I thought it was about time they started telling their neighbors, because everybody in town was seeing the same thing, almost everybody. And here they were not telling anyone for fear of ridicule.
Yeah.
So here, Nancy Talbot is spending, 45 minutes, an hour now with us, looking at really strict scientific information, and now we're spending the last 10 or 15 minutes looking at the correlation of life experiences with people on farms with things that are UFO in nature. I just find that really interesting that kind of correlation is made, and that it seems to be a consistent theme throughout some of the things you're talking about. I don't know, it just seems to be...
It's curious how it's evolved.
Yeah.
I mean, our interest has been, and still is, to do as much good, plain, old-fashioned hard science as we can, because we will learn about the physical aspect of whatever this is that's going on. But what we find is that every direction you go in, at a certain point, you get thrown back on something that is beyond what science seems to know how to deal with. And this may be exactly what's, you know, where it's going to go eventually. I don't know. But I know that there is very little evidence. In fact, there's almost no evidence of anything that you would call a UFO directly making a crop circle. However, UFOs are reported fairly regularly now in an area where crop circles have formed in the past or are forming now, various light phenomena, sometimes actual craft. This case, the herringbone case that we're going to talk about, has an actual craft of some sort apparently present right near the site where the crop circle was found.
Oh.
And this is occurring more and more frequently. And if you're going to be honest, I mean, if you're going to look at all the data, you've got to look at all the data.
Yes.
And if half of the people or three-quarters of them are reporting strange lights in the sky and craft and other things, choosing to ignore that is dishonest. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not doing research if you're selectively paying attention to some things and ignoring the rest.
Yes, exactly. Nancy, let's talk about the herringbone formation, because we have about less than 6 minutes left.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Well, not wonderful. We don't have time, but yes, let's get to it.
Yes.
This is a fascinating event that just occurred a few weeks ago in Ohio, in southern Ohio, in Greene County. I can't give the exact location because the farmer doesn't want me to.
Hmm.
But in this case, the lay of the crop is absolutely unique. No one, as far as I can tell, anywhere in the world has seen this before, this thing in Greene County. What it is a very clear lay that results in a herringbone pattern in the laid crop. with one bundle of wheat in one row lopped over and under the next several rows.
Mm.
It's an extremely complex lay. There, in this particular case, there are 60 rows that are affected in a very square pattern. Now, as you know, crop circles, you know, aren't generally square. So it's unusual because the thing is basically square, and it's even more unusual because of the way the wheat is interwoven in this pattern. Now, we've been diagramming the rows that are involved. There are 60 rows across, and we've been figuring out precisely how each row was laid, trying to figure out how it could have been done. And I don't see how, with people in full daylight, 20 of them in that field, that they could possibly have done this. The plants are grabbed sort of lump by, you know, a lump of them at a time, and then bent at a 45-degree angle toward the next row, which can be either bent toward them or away from them, up or down. And there's a very distinct pattern. It's four rows are done in a certain way, then four rows are done in a different way. Then the two patterns repeat themselves all the way across this thing. But the plants are not broken. It was dry wheat. The farmer found it at harvest. And how you could even flatten dry wheat like that without breaking it, I don't know, much less weaving it, you know, in this sort of pattern.
Yeah, we're looking at the pictures as you're talking, and that's in the updates area of bltresearch.com. For those of you who are not connected, as Victor said earlier on, you look at it and it's kind of like the way braids are made in hair.
Yes, yes. And what's interesting is that the farmer discovered this particular one, as I said, at harvest on his combine, and he rode over part of it, one edge of it, before he realized what it was. And he found it at around 2:30 in the afternoon on July 5th. That same afternoon, a nearby neighbor, 2 hours later, was on his deck out behind his house, he and his wife, and they observed in a bright blue, sunny sky, one very small, very low to the horizon, cloud-like object. At first, they thought it simply was a cumulus cloud, but it didn't move. It was very small. There were no other clouds in the sky. And they started to notice this strange flickering. He said at first it was rather like a fluorescent light.
Hmm.
When you turn it on or off and you get that flickering.
Yep.
But then they started to notice that it started to change colors. And these lights would be an orangey, purpley color. He said not blue like a transformer going off, more like an ignition system of some sort. And the lights would go on in some sort of a sequence and hold for 2 or 3 seconds at a time, then disappear for a certain period of time, then come back on. And they observed this for about 20 minutes, a very deliberate sequence of lighting. And then all of a sudden, the cloud just disappeared. Now, I don't know. Maybe it was a very unusual cloud, but there was no storm. There was no thunder. There was no rain, you know, nothing that would indicate anything, any normal storm situation. And in fact, a week and a half later, when our field workers were there actually sampling, they had another observation of what they believe is the same object in the same general area, but about 10 o'clock at night, doing this with the same strange light pattern that seemed to be deliberate.
I wonder if there's any correlation between the light pattern flashes, the numbers of sequences in the light flashing, with any kind of correlation with the number of rows. And you said there was a pattern to the rows, too.
Very distinct pattern, and I don't know.
Yeah.
They didn't count the flashes.
Yeah, you'd have to videotape it, I guess.
I guess.
Well,
but again, it's another example of, in this case, a very unusual crop circle with two very good witnesses, very clear, very lucid, to this unusual aerial light phenomenon.
Nancy Talbot of BLT Research, and we just plumb ran out of time again. My BLTresearch.com is the website. Go look, explore, and educate yourself about what's going on in the farmlands around the planet. Nancy, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we look forward to having you back on again.
Great.
We'll try and pick it up rather than repeat what we've done in the past. Talk to you soon, Nancy.
Hey, bye-bye.
Good night. Thanks.
Good night, Nancy.
Oh, my.
Incredible. You have to listen in amazement, no matter which way the conversation goes. It just it takes you in directions that you're just not accustomed to thinking, and it's a great exercise.
Yeah. By the same token, though, the thing is, a lot of the skeptics and the skeptobunkers have talked about the fact that there's no scientific research. That is pure science.
I think you followed. You could learn
that.
We'd all learn a lesson from that.
Let's look at the stuff that's there.
We have to bail, guys. Victor Vigiani, thank you. Dave Furlutt, thank you. Big Daddy B, Dean Gualandi, Jim Pacheco, thank you all for being out there. We'll talk to you next week at 9 p.m. Eastern. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions.